George Robb, before I take you into the mine, I want to tell you all about it so you know what you're looking at. This is part of the Arara gold field. Goodness knows how many old gold mines would be in the area. I know of 64 old gold mines myself. I've lived here all my life. Anyway, I knew six of the original old miners, but two of the mines I wish to tell you about, one was very lucky, the other wasn't. The first bloke, his name was George Ellis. And George was the most successful miner to come into the area, even though he'd done a lot of work sometimes and missed out. Now, to start him on his way, this is back in 1894. He was only 19 years old. He was working on a cattle station north of here. It was known then as Kangaroo Creek Station. That's between here and Grafton. He'd heard of gold, he found the area. He told his boss he's leaving his job. He's going looking for gold. His boss, who owned the cattle station at that time, his name was Jack Shea, an Irishman. I remember Jack. Jack died in 1954. Because Jack thought it was a big joke, he laughed at George and told George he'd die of starvation. That never stopped George from going. That made him more determined to go. He packed up his gear and away he went out in the wilderness on his own. He'd only been gone a couple of weeks when he found gold, and very rich it was too. It was alluvial gold like the defining creeks, and this gold was along in the yellow tacky clay in the bottom of a gully. He named it Clay Gully, is still known as Clay Gully. It's situated about 8 miles northwest from here. Now, in a very short period, in 2 years, George found somewhere about 900 ounces of gold, which is a lot of gold for one bloke to find. There's never been found rich like that here before or since. Nevertheless, George found it. Why, he's still getting this good gold. He never let the secret out for almost 12 months. Then it was let out by mistake, because when he did, he started up a gold rush. Mines have flocked all along this clay gully. We have no idea how much others found. All that in clay gully, there was little nuggets of gold. That's why I got it quicker. It was nuggety type gold. You may know that when gold in a creek like that, it has washing from somewhere, usually a mother load up in the hills above it. And George stayed there for another 8 or 9 months trying to find where the gold came from. Still getting a bit of gold while he's looking. And some of these other miners stayed back with George and helped him look. It was never found where that gold came from in the clay gully, and people still go up there looking for it, including me. I reckon someday some lucky person will find it. Now, you can understand that was a big starter from life, young bloke, 19, 20-year-old. Be like winning the lotto today. When he finished there, he continued looking for gold. He prospected one this area, but all heavily timbered here then. And he was hodging around these creeks, still getting alluvial gold. These creeks are all gold-bearing. They've all been worked over and over, but not rich like Clay Gully. Ended up, George had 4 gold mines around this area. Now, back in 1907, the government threw all this part of the country open for settlement. There were 31 farms in this area here, and George selected this 241-acre property beside the creek and what you see at the lookout. But always his living was gold. He couldn't think of anything else. Whenever he had a bit of spare time, he used to go prospecting on his own property. Scattered along the big hill above us here, there's 3 groups of old gold mines, but this is the biggest mine on the property. In 1932, away up on the hill above us where those shaft mines are marked on your map, some people do walk down to that group with a track going down there, he found a very rich reef of quartz, and where he found it, it was going 3 ounces of gold to the tonne. That's considered very rich when you're talking about gold. He immediately started mine up there. He dug a shaft, that's a big hole down, removing the quartz. About 30 feet down though, unexpectedly and very prematurely, the gold just fizzled out like it cut out. George went down a few more feet. There's still no more gold there. So in disgust, he walked away and left it. He went back out to one of his other mines. It might be just like a rich patch he found. 34 ounces he recovered out of the rich patch. That'd be worth somewhere about $16,500 today. Now, when this happened with gold, though, when it cuts out like that in a reef, providing the reef is still going down, in this case up here it was, if you like to continue working on the reef, like this, following the reef, straight underneath where the gold was, it is possible for it to make back on rich gold again at a lower level. But it's all a big gamble, and George didn't worry about it. It was back in the days of the Great Depression when this was going on. This is 1933 now. And this chap called Ken Bayfield came wandering into the mining, into the area, carrying his swag. Ken was from Norway, but it's an English sort of name. He was 27-year-old. He met up with George. He was asking George all the questions in the world about gold mining, but George was telling Ken how this reef could be good at a lower level. And George suggested to Ken, he said, if you want something to do, want to drive a tunnel, like dig a tunnel in this hill and intersect the reef at a lower level. Because Ken couldn't get in there fast enough, he started tunneling his way in there. In there at the 100-foot mark, he came across this great big reef of quartz, about 3 feet wide. He went through it, he went along it. He took 24 tonne of the quartz out. It all stacked here in front here for George to crush in the stamper battery. Ken thought the quartz was assaying somewhere between 1 and 4 ounces per tonne. But before they took it over to have it crushed, George came over. He ran a dozen tests on the quartz for Ken. He told Ken it was only going between 1 and 4 pennyweights per tonne, not ounces. In case you didn't know, in the troy weight that American, lots of countries still use, there's 20 pennyweights and an ounce. Anyway, George told Ken to dump the quartz he reckoned was too low grade to take to a battery. But Ken didn't believe him. He just couldn't believe he'd done all his hard work for nothing. He thought George was wrong, not him. He persuaded George into crushing the quartz for him by promising he'd still pay him so much a ton to have it crushed. Anyway, George didn't like letting Ken down, and after a lot of thought, he said he'd crush the quartz, but one condition was Ken had to help him get the firewood for the boiler. The batteries run with steam then. They had to go out with axes and chop up a great stack of firewood. Then they had to drag the wood in with a horse. But the worst was they had to get this 24 tonne of quartz over the other side of the creek. There was no bridge there. I put the sort of a bridge there. They had to get all across there by hand and load it by hand into a 1926 model international truck. The bloke on the truck who's over in Grafton, he's 89-year-old now. Then they had to cart the quartz out to George's other battery. Was out here on the Glenray-Dorrigo Road. There was 4 trips for the truck, and all this took 5 days. Took another 5 days then to put that quartz through the battery, and all I got out of it was not quite 2 ounces of gold. This is for 2 years and 3 weeks of hard work. Ken, he looked at the bit of gold. He immediately thought George robbed him. He lost his temper. He called George all the nasty names you could think of. But George wasn't real happy about this, more so the insult of accuser robbing him. He told Ken he'd finished with him, he'd never crush any more quartz again for him. Well, nobody else around had another battery, so Ken had to pack up his gear and go. But George is to reckon the reef that Ken found in there is not the reef he's looking for. It's an unknown one he found on the way in, which confused everything. And the one they're looking for is still somewhere in the hill further. He used to say that some rainy day he was going to take the tunnel further himself. But that rainy day never came. He was so involved with other mining. And that kept other miners out. It's never been touched on when we opened to the public 20 years ago. We had it cleaned all out, re-timbered, and have been inspected by a Department of Mines inspector, which is still subject to those inspections, so it's quite safe. Now, on the world standard of mines, I suppose you'd class this as a very small mine. But I want you to remember, as you're looking, that 99% of it was put in there by one bloke on his own, which we think made it so interesting. He worked 7 days a week. He worked long hours because the only light he had in there was candlelight. The other 1%, over in the next holler, is the old Dorrigo Railway line. There used to be a village here. They called this place Moulton. There used to be about 25 houses, a school, a shop and a post office and a big sawmill. Sometimes after school, some of the schoolboys used to come over and give Ken a bit of a hand, including my brother. But only 4 that ever helped him. My brother is only still alive out of those 4. And the whole 4 time in 2 years, mainly helped them about 6 or 7 days altogether, and that was mainly willing an oar out for him. They never ever came together, and never came every day, every month or so. And by the 2 ounces of gold they recovered, George kept it for the use of his battery. So really, Ken walked out of here with nothing. It's really a hard luck story. Unfortunately, I can't take you to George's mine. It's a vertical shaft. But it's still part of the same mine, but they're not connected. And all the other rock that came out of here, the path of the quartz, they call that mullock. He had it stacked all along the creek on this level, out to the water's edge. But the floods over the years have swept it all down the creek. That's why there's no rock out in front. We estimate he removed at least 450 tonnes of rock, besides the 24 tonnes of quartz for 2 ounces of gold. That's they call gold fever, so they get hooked. Over the course of such rich gold they found up on the surface, there's still a big chance it would be in here somewhere. I was 18 when George died. I knew him very well. And Dad worked with George for about 3 years on the mines, but not the mines along the hill here above us. And George and Dad never helped Ken. One more thing. You may wonder how Ken lived all this time, what he did for money. One time, all governments had to have gold to back the money. He was paid a small subsidy from the government to put this in. They call miners' aid. He's paid about somewhere between 5 and 6 shillings those times for every foot he went in. And if he struck it rich, he was supposed to pay something back to the government. That's why I had to work so try and make a wage out of it. He was only paid 63 in size in feet. If he made it bigger, he never got extra pay for that. Apart from that, it was a Fraser government back in the 1970s who stopped subsidising gold miners. It was a thing instead of the dole. They're supposed to keep the blokes working. They strike minerals supposed to help the country. Well, we thought it was possible for Ken to be still alive. We found he only died a few years before we opened this up. And they said wherever he was up in Queensland, he was still gold mining up there, but nobody's followed on to see whether he struck it rich. I'd like to hang his photo on the wall. And when he was here, there's a house just across where those big pear trees are, but the house is, of course, not there now. Now, I'll walk you into the mine. Here's the reef of quartz that Ken found. This is where he went through the reef and then he followed along. He's above your head and under your feet, also going through there in a southwest direction. Now this reef, it has an odd speck of gold in it, known as a colour. Naturally, like it, you keep following it, hope you're going to find it rich somewhere. But in that reef somewhere, in any direction, it's not impossible for it to have been a foot or less of a fortune and never knew it. Because it's so wide here, he thought that could have been an indication of another reef coming in behind it, making it wider. If there was, that's where it could have been rich. He dug this hole in here to check on that. There was nothing in there. That took him 5 days to put that in there. Probably take me 5 weeks. Now, all these little lights above here, they're glowworms. At night time, it's extremely beautiful in here with glowworms. You can walk straight through and back again without lights or torches. But you don't see many in the daytime. They don't like being disturbed. They seem to know the difference between night and day. We bring special tours in here at night and usually walk straight through and back again without lights or torches. But not as bright as the electric light, of course, not even this bright as this one. I'll put my hand over the light. Now, we'll go up the next section. This here, there's a branch going in that direction. We none of us know why Ken put this tunnel in here. He went up in there 55 feet. He never found anything that looked gold that direction, not even quartz. And that took him 7.5 weeks to put that tunnel in. Remember, of course, he had to get the rock out as he was doing it. A little trolley to run the wooden tracks. And once he blasted, he couldn't come back in again that day with the gelignite fumes. And to drill a hole in those rock, like a drill hole there above you, all he had was the old hammer and tap drill. It was a steel drill sharpened like a chisel on the forge by him. The old miners had their own blacksmith to run everything. He drilled a hole in about somewhere near 3 feet. He had a charge up a gelignite, light the fuse and tear out every time. I've done a bit of gold mining myself, mainly as a hobby at weekends, and to put a hole that far in rock by hand by yourself with one of those drills would take at least 2 hours, about 5 or 6 minutes with a compressor and jackhammer. Now we'll just move up to the next section. As we walk along, the reef you're following, his following is on the left of you here. You can see where he's taken big junks out of it to make up that 24 tonnes. Now here we are in the last section I take into. I want to show the point this torch up above us here. This is where, when they start mining upwards like that, taking the quartz out, is called a stope, S-T-O-P-E, or stoping. Now in these gold mines, when they're stoping like that, they usually go almost to the surface, because they can't go too close to the surface, it'd fall in. Ken stoped up in here, then he started off with a bit of tunnel that direction. The main reason he went up in there, they're still showing a few specks of gold up in there. Now, I shine the torch up there, you can see that other reef right up on top there. Well, then you can see the reef coming down here. It's a branch off the other reef. these reefs have branches like trees, and you call those branches leaders. So from here on, you've got two to follow, the leader and the other big reef both running along together. You may find an odd speck of gold in a reef or a leader, whatever thing you're following, but when you come to where the rich gold's in it, it usually goes down through the quartz in a strip, and that strip is known as a chute. All specks of gold going down for the quartz, because you're hoping there's nuggets. In most cases, gold goes straight down in a quartz reef, and sometimes it does go great distances. After you mine the chute out in the shaft, you continue mining away along the reef looking for the next chute. At this depth, they could easily miss some above you. On the ground there, just behind you there, there's a bit of a shaft there. It was filled in, so nobody would fall down it. When this intersection came into it, it bumped the big reef up to a third of an ounce to the ton, which is almost worth mining today. Ken knew that, but he also knew that's not the rich one he was looking for. So he kept on tunnelling up here looking for it. He was going to come back later, continue mining this year, hoping it got richer. But when he had a row with George, because he had to abandon the whole lot, because he couldn't get it crushed, he got up in there another 50 feet, and that's where George said he should have went further. You're 146, 147 feet underground here. Anyway, the idea of this was to show people the hardship and hard work they went through chasing gold. So if there's anything else you want to know about it, you're welcome to ask me. That's what I'm here for. And because we're dealing with the public, everything I told you had to be full of research. Could make sure we're right. We didn't want to make our big lies out of ourselves, because there's more people than us knew about this. So we went back in full research of it to make sure we're right. And none of us know why he made so big as this. Mostly one man mines only about 3 feet wide. But we heard he made it bigger for air reasons, to give himself plenty of air, because he wasn't sure how far in that he was taking it. In case you didn't know, that's why they use the candles. As soon as the candle starts going out, he's got to get out, see, running out of air. People are always asking me why I don't mine it further myself. I suppose it's tempting. I should have done it 30 years ago. But we think by touching it now would be foolish. We'd take the authentic part away from it. We think it's better to leave the mist up in there, leaves a monument for Ken Bayfield. I do a bit of prospecting on my own property. Got a few holes dug around the place. A couple showing a bit of gold too, but I haven't much time to work, and I'm tourist and visitor schools to keep me too busy. Thank you. Now, that's all I have to tell you here. We've got to take you back now, explain the battery to you, and show you the battery working. Now, here we are at the battery. This little battery has been sitting here in this position since 1908, not long after George selected the property in 1907, he erected this. It's well over 100-year-old, still working. That company there, Park and Lacey, was at a suburb of Sydney called Glebe. Well, we had to make a few alterations on the old building since it's a bit new along here. We had to put a new, also a few new posts and stop it falling over. And my dad replaced the steam back in 1950 with a diesel motor that drives it now. There's not many of these old things still working commercially in Australia, if any. It's the old method of recovering gold. First up, they use a lot of water. This is coupled onto a pump down here. It pumps water from the creek into one operation. It pumps water up in this drum, but you can see the homemade drum and the plastic pipe there is also a bit of my work. Years ago, George had a hollow log sitting along there made into a trough he used as a tank. That's it laying out there in the ground. You put the quartz in the chute on the other side, and as the stampers drop up and down, crushing the quartz, that middle stamper is supposed to bump that bar behind there, and that shakes the quartz in. That's a self-feeding device that George rigged onto it. Right. All that sand you see going out there is the quartz. That's how fine it has to be crushed to recover the gold out of it. It has to be crushed fine enough to come through this screen, which acts like a sieve. And that screen is gauged at 900 holes per square inch. Would be one of the finest gauge wires you'd buy. You still buy this sort of wire in the city. It's almost the price of gold too. That's a stainless steel one. Anyway, these here are all copper plates, they're all pure copper. And they have a coating of mercury on them, or quicksilver. All this little stuff you see on them plates is mercury. You may know that mercury will stick to copper when the copper's clean. You can paint it on, it'll stick there like glue or paint. But all, mercury also sticks to gold, so as soon as the fine gold comes out and touches the mercury, it's immediately held onto it. It's not just Hilda either. Mercury and gold, when they come together, they amalgamate. And this old method of recovering gold was known as recovering gold by amalgamation. Now, any biggest fix of gold in that quartz, they won't come through that screen. If they got caught in there, they're only going to get flattened. They all drop into the bottom of the battery box. You call this middle part the battery box or the mortar box. And every day, if we work commercially, every couple of hours, you drop a spoonful of turmeric in this box. It falls in behind and amalgamates with the gold in there. And that's where all your best gold is going to be. There's only a certain amount of fine gold that comes out on the plates. Now, this quartz I'm crushing at the moment is pretty low grade. It's only got an odd speck in it. It's mainly a demonstration. But all the time, there's a bit of gold come on the plates. I want to show you what it looks like in amalgam. You can see how the mercury is all raising up there and all going rough. That's the gold in amalgamation form. Sometimes we have to take some off there. We get worried about someone coming here at night and pinching it. The mercury just changes the colour of the gold, makes the gold silver looking. And most of the gold there would be as fine as flour. You probably never see it, and the mercury picks it up. If that was a rich stone I was crushing, you see the gold all over the plates, but more so the top plate where it first touches it. And that yellowy look on the plates there, that's like a scum that comes over the mercury. If that scum got too thick on there, when the gold came out, it wouldn't touch the mercury, just keeps going straight through. And the usual chemical we use to keep these plates clean, which is meant to be used on there, is a deadly poison called cyanide. But I don't use cyanide here now, just in case some little children got poisoned, but it keeps the mercury nice and clean and active. Another chemical I just put on a moment ago, not as good as cyanide, but it wasn't very poisonous, something you buy at the supermarket. Now, after you finish your crushing, you may have crushed 10 or 12 tonnes of quartz, whatever you had. When you finish, you have to scrape the mercury off the plates. That's what you use, a hard bit of rubber, a bit of leather. I'm putting a fair bit of weight on there. You can see how hard that mercury sticks to copper. After you finish scraping the plates, you then remove the screen, clean the box out and get all your good stuff that's in behind. It should look like great big hard bit of mercury dust. It's amalgam. Because the more gold in it, the harder the amalgam will be. So now you have to separate the mercury from the gold. This unusual looking thing I'm picking up here is called a mercury retort. The amalgam is placed inside the retort, bolted down tight and placed in a fire. The end of the pipe goes in a bucket of water. The pipe is kept cool with cold water running onto it. A distilling process takes place. As you know, mercury rises and gets hot like it does in a thermometer. But under extreme heat, mercury evaporates, goes like in a vaporous steam. It rises in that form. Soon as it touches the cool side pipe, it'll condense and just run back pure mercury in the bucket of water. If you use the mercury back in the plates, it leaves your gold sitting in the retort. When we use this, you have to be very careful in case any mercury is escaping anywhere. You wouldn't see it be transparent, like invisible. If there was, and if you inhale those fumes, I believe you're in very serious troubles. You always get away from a little work on its own. Now, the gold's not ready to be sold yet. You have to melt it into an ingot, like a bar of gold, and clean it in the one process. Particularly clean it, that means in amongst the gold, there's all a few specks of black stuff. It looks like bits of carbon or charcoal. Would have to be lifted out before you get your good price for it. Because these times, they mill gold with gas. But years ago, all they had was old blacksmith equipment. This is a little forge. They blows air up in the fire to make things red hot. They use coal or charcoal. This is a very small forge. It's a very old one. George never owned this. I bought this at an antique shop just to show the school kids. George had done all this in his blacksmith shop just over past the boilers. I tried to rebuild his blacksmith shop, but I couldn't replace what he had to pump air. He had a great big leather bellows, a 9 foot long, great big leather puffing thing, but it rotted away years ago. The gold's taken out of the court, retort, and placed in this thing called a crucible, bare made of graphite, and thus stand a very hot temper without breaking. Now, gold are only soft metal. It takes at least 1200 degrees to melt gold, but before it melts, or as it melts, you start tossing another chemical, borax, into it. What maybe put 6 or even 20 spoonfuls of borax. We also put a couple of spoonfuls of bicarbonate soda with it. That acts as a flux. It boils amongst the gold and cleans it. Lifts those impurities out and they'll all come scale at the top like a slag. A bit like a slag when they're electric welding. Anyway, you just pour the lot in the mould to make the ingot. But the mould has to be preheated, or else a sudden change in temperature, something could blow out. The slag will still come back to top again when it cools and settles a bit. You just have a light with a hammer or something, it falls off and leaves ingot underneath. This is a 200-ounce mould that I've never filled, only in my dreams. On today's Australian price of gold, this will be worth at least $96,000 full of gold. I check in the price of gold every morning. This morning, it was about $477 an ounce in Australia. The price you see on TV is always American dollars. You add about $200 onto that, gives you roughly about Australian dollars. My George and Dad, when they finished their crushing, they used to have it about a third or a half full. When they had a third fill, that's about 5 minutes, 5 months' work, just one third for that. But other moulds, they've disappeared over the years. This is the last of George's moulds I got left. There's a few other moulds about here that I'll just show you that I've obtained that since George left here. He had other moulds, they all disappeared over the years. And this big mould here was donated to me by a company down Coffs Harbour. I think they were having a joke with me. This is a 1,000-ounce mould, worth about $500,000 full of gold, of course. If I fill that every 10 years, I'd be quite happy. Now, the battery itself, the thing does all the crushing. You can't see them behind the screen. We call them the shoes or the hammers. And that's what they look like wore out. This was really about this thick, about 10, 12 inches thick. And they wear down like this, didn't they? Break if you don't take them off in time. Sometimes an extra hard quartz, you may only get a few months' work out of them. This would be one of the smallest batteries you'd ever see. On the ground there, there's a big one, those shoes, but I won't pick it up for you. It's not that big steel battery sitting on the ridge just over there. That big battery came from a place called Nundle, up near Tamworth, only brought here about 26, 27 years ago. It was made at a place called Castlemaine, Victoria, by Thompson's engineers in 1897. It was originally a 20 stamper, or you can say 20 head. This is only three. But the blokes who put that section up for me put it up wrong. It looks pretty sitting over there, but it'll never work. Someday we'd like to put it down and fix it up and have a look at. Now, just up on the hill up there on the other property is the second biggest gold mine in the area. It's the second biggest mine to the Advanced Australia mine. It's called the Lady Mary Mine. Various work out, it was found by a lady called Mary. Back in 1915, a tree had uprooted. It brought up quartz was coming up. She was out getting the cows, and she picked a bit of quartz and the specks of gold all over the quartz. It was going 4 ounces of gold to the ton. That's very, very rich. Well, George gave her some sort of reward for finding it. I'm uncertain on the exact amount. He started mining there, but the deeper he went down, the more trouble he had with water. His son, he mined about here, they had trouble with water. Well, he ended up selling to a company. They put men on there working shift work. They had 12-hour shifts. And to keep the steam pumps going 24 hours a day. Somewhere down about the 170-foot level in the main workings, the mine got flooded. And all the pumps and things are still underneath there somewhere. They tried hard to get them out. They bought other pumps, and they were wondering why the pumps weren't making any progress. Then they realised they were pumping the creek. They were nowhere near the creek, but the creek was still getting through. There must be an underground stream there somewhere. Out of that mine, between George and the company together, they recovered 634 ounces of gold, which is very good for that depth. It shows any of that tree coming up, nobody ever found it. So the mystery still could reach somewhere about, not found yet. I've been looking for these reefs all my life. I find lots of reefs, I can't find that good rich one. And all this machinery was dragged up from Coffs Harbour to here years ago with bullock teams before the roads at all. Must have been brought up on those ridges out along there. Really amazing what they did years ago with the bullocks and horses, wasn't it? I suppose those things happened everywhere. Now, we're going to start the battery up and show it to you working for a couple of minutes. This little battery would only crush below about 2.5 ton in 24 hours. It was going all the time. And years ago, the quartz you brought to this little battery had to be going very close to 1 ounce to the ton to make it pay. That also applies today on these small batteries by the time you get the quartz out of the mine. As I mentioned before, George had another big battery out on the Glenray-Dorrigo Road, and for mines in that direction, including the Bayfield mine, he used it. It was a big 5-stamper battery, twice as big as this. My dad sold it about 48 years ago. He said this one would do us. But these things now are museum pieces. Until recently, the chap out there was using it. It was all George's wish to move that battery to this property. After all these years, this bloke fulfilled George's wish in 1994. He brought it back, erected over the hill there for me near the other battery. That's over there with the poles holding it up. He donated that battery back to me, so he got four of these old batteries now. Now, it might interest you, the lubrication I use on these cams here, that is golden syrup. You can use syrup, treacle, molasses, you could probably put honey. Whatever you use, you never use grease or oil. If any grease or oil happened to fall and touch the mercury, it'll immediately dull the mercury and upset everything. It's an enemy of mercury and gold grease and oil. You might notice it, but all the fine gold will start floating. After a while, the mercury started moving and the amalgam. He'd end up losing the lot down the drain somewhere if he didn't wake up what was going on. That must have been found out by trial and error. Now, from there on out, you call that the tailings, like the sands. Out in the paddock there, there's big mounds of these tailings. This little battery has crushed with six mines that I know of, and there's been huge amounts of sand taken away over the years. People are using it for concreting, like paths and things. Now, there used to be another group of blokes come along and go around all the batteries and pay the owners a percentage of the gold that would recover out in the tailings. And sometimes out of those big heaps, they'd recover hundreds of ounces of gold. They didn't go near a battery, a company had, because the company treat themselves. And how the gold got out there, unless it's perfectly clean, it just won't stick to the mercury. Mainly what have been dirty is coated with another mineral. Through those sands going out, you see these other black minerals going out. Some of them, of course, is gold with a coating of another mineral over it, usually a 9 coating, and the same things happen on work and I can't do much about it. And all through those sands, there's microscopic sized gold still stuck in the quartz. Now, it's exactly 63 years ago since they treated that. I just thought I'd tell you, in a brief simplified version, how they did it. Cyanide will just about dissolve any mineral if you soak it in it long enough. It's very severe stuff. It won't hurt mercury. Seems to do it good. Doesn't seem to hurt those copper plates either. But cyanide will dissolve all these other minerals that's going out, including gold. There's only two things I know of that dissolve gold. One is cyanide. When we use cyanide in those plates to clean them, you ought to be careful. You don't put it on there too strong or leave it on there too long. Now, when gold is dissolved with cyanide, it goes back into a liquid substance. Looks a bit like muddy water or thin mud, of course, a bit yellow looking. They used to use that big tank out there in the paddock as a vat. There was two of those big tanks, and they were lined with the tarry stuff to protect the tanks so they wouldn't dissolve them. And they soaked all the sands in the solution of cyanide for at least a week and a half. Now, when everything was dissolved, they used to turn a tap on the tank slowly, like a trickle running out of it. It is run slowly out through like a long wooden box. In this wooden box, every foot or so along the box, they had a department across the box. And in these departments, they had shavings of pure zinc placed in there. It would have looked like steel wool. Now, when this came back in contact with zinc, in a very short time after, say within 2 or 3 hours after, a mineral reaction took place, and the gold came from a liquid back to pure gold again after contact and zinc, clear of the other minerals. They stayed dissolved, but the gold returned. It used to then stick onto the zinc, then they'd soak or dip the zinc in nitric acid to dissolve the zinc to free the gold. It was all a complicated turnout. That's only a simplified version, but it was very, very close to what I told you. They called that leaching. George wouldn't have a go at that. He reckoned them blokes out there run a big risk of inhaling cyanide fumes. And I believe they still use that same method in parts of Australia this moment, the cyanide and zinc. They try and keep it a secret from those extremist greenies. Apparently they knew about this amalgamation process about 800 years ago. They never had any batteries. They must have had it crushed by hand. It was only a bit over 100 years ago they found about the zinc. They knew where these batteries work and all this gold was getting wasted. And the bloke found that out, he was a German scientist. And soon he hit the jackpot of bringing this gold back. He went around the world, he became a multi-millionaire. He wouldn't have the secret out to what he was doing until he became very wealthy. Then I suppose they had to buy it off him. I only heard the year before last that he lived to be 98 years old. So he must have knew how to handle cyanide. He never got caught with it, and I believe it wasn't cyanide that killed him then. Now, I haven't showed you any real gold yet, have I? Only this bit of amalgam, as I told you what that was. You may not know what it was. I want to show you how we know the quartz has got gold in it. A sense another, of course, if you ever went prospecting. Now, this thing I'm picking up here is called a dolly pot. And this thing's called a dolly. They're old names, the mines used to call them. And the only way you can tell was any gold in this quartz or any quartz, unless you're terrible lucky to see it, is put in this pot, dolly it up real fine, and then pan it. It's not very often can I break a bit of this quartz freshly and show you gold. I like to see a little nugget every time I break it. But it doesn't seem to work out like that. On a real dirty, rusty looking quartz, it has been known to go over 5 ounces of the ton, even higher, and not necessarily will you see it if it's fine like mustard flour. That is true, that, but don't get me wrong, none of the stuff about here is going 5 ounces a ton. I wouldn't be sitting here talking about it if it was, I'd be probably cruising around the world. This stuff I'm dolling for you is going about an ounce to the ton. Sometimes gold shows up if you wet the quartz. You might see people walking around spitting on quartz or licking quartz. They do that also with opals. As soon as gold gets wet, it shines up more so, but if I go wetting this stuff, I can't doll it. It sticks in the bottom of the pot. Sometimes I run a magnifying glass over it, and not very often do we even see it with a magnifying glass. Anyway, I won't keep yapping about the muffy nothing in it, but I've had a good run here this last 12 months. I've only missed out about 8 or 9 times for just showing people a few specks of gold, but I haven't missed out on this quartz, but I haven't missed out on other quartz. Sometimes I haven't got time to pick out the mine. I pick any piece around the place and dial it. When I do that, sometimes I miss out because I do try and pick the quartz out that's got gold in it. Thank you very much. Now, I'll put this in the pan and I'll pan it for you and get it clean. And as I swirl the pan around, I'll wash a little bit of this quartz out over the lip. And the lip or a groove, and that's supposed to stop the gold going out. But you do it very gently. If you go too rough, you can wash the gold out. And I do this very gently. I just take this, wash it out of the water, out of this gravel out that I've crushed up, and by rights, if everything's right, and if it's got gold in it, the last piece of quartz I wash out of this pan, there should be a little trail of gold in the bottom of the pan. So here we go. We'll have a go at it now. Now here's, look, you can see these specks of gold, little trail of a gold here. Now, this is not a bad little trail either. The trail for about a quarter an inch, no wider than the match, and for every quarter inch long, that little trail represents at least 0.5 ounce to the ton you're going to recover out of that battery. That's an indication, like a guide, it's not a trace. At least you know you're going to get that much. If you had more, because that's your good luck. Now sometimes I get this much, sometimes nothing. This is heaps better than nothing. But sometimes I do get a great big heavy trail in the pan. When that happens, apart from almost starting a gold rush around the place, it usually means I've picked up a richer piece amongst us somewhere. If you want to imagine for a big disappointment when you finish, because you're going to overestimate it, so you average it by dialing it 3 or 4 times and dial it, but that should just about average it out. Now, look at this little trail of gold. I'd say that's just a fraction over an ounce a ton. But sometimes I have to get a big trail to make up the time to miss out of it. But sometimes only a few specks there, sometimes nothing. Now, you'd starve doing this with a dolly pot, but that's running over the mercury will do the counts. And that's the little trail has worked out, say, from about a handful of quartz, and you crush it up, and that should leave the trail. Gives you an idea of how much the gold is contained in the quartz. Thank you very much.